Welcome back, everybody, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. There are times when people absolutely need to be represented by an attorney, and there's nothing wrong with that. Attorneys have their place, mediators have their place, document preparation people have their place, and the court has its place. And we're all there to help you whatever you need. Today we have Matthew Smyrda, a phenomenal family law attorney, and this is why I think you're a phenomenal family law attorney, Matthew, because you're exceptional at what you do, you have a heart, and you want to make sure you only charge the appropriate amount of money. You do not take people for a ride. Matthew, thank you for coming.
My pleasure, Judy. Thank you so much for having me. And the feeling is mutual. I know whenever I send clients your way, they are in great hands, whether you're going to help them as a document preparer or as mediator in whatever capacity. So it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure back. Thank you so much. So Matthew's topic today is, tell them, Matthew.
The top five mistakes that people make when they are going through a family law case. And these can apply to a divorce case. These can apply to a paternity case where the parties are not married but have a minor child, or any other type of issue that may fall under the jurisdiction of the family law court. So I've been doing this for about 10 years, in the field for 12, and I've seen a lot. I've helped a lot of people resolve their cases, and I've seen a lot of people make mistakes, and I have people come to me after they make mistakes needing me to help kind of clean things up and get them back on track. So I'm happy to be here and share some of the wisdom and insight that I have learned, and hopefully can help some people.
But Matthew, there are ways that your clients, if they knew how things worked to their advantage, they wouldn't make some mistakes. Some of them being money, some of them being how they use time and your services. So number one, what's number one of the five biggest mistakes people make?
Absolutely. And before I say that, I want to agree with you. You're 100% correct. I think knowledge is power for anyone going through this process. So the more people learn about the process, the more they talk to the professionals that work in the system every day, the better off they're going to be. And so that brings me, though, to point number one, mistake number one, I should say, which is when clients use their lawyer as their therapist.
Yes. So what's it like? Give an example.
Sure. So even as recently as yesterday, I received a call from a client of mine, and she's going through a very, very bitter contested divorce. Her husband has filed a restraining order against her and even obtained a temporary restraining order based upon the paperwork that he filed, which she has not yet even had a chance to respond to. And under that restraining order, not only is she, prohibited from getting within a certain distance of him, she can't really contact him unless it has to do with peaceful communication about the children. But in the restraining order, there's an addendum that a lot of people use to ask for interim temporary child custody orders. And so under the orders that the husband was able to get, he has essentially a 50-50 timeshare. And it's under a schedule that's not really desirable for the young children that they have, there's 4-year-old twins and a 1-year-old. And under this schedule, literally the children bounce day to day from mom's house to dad's house. And on top of that, mom lives in the South Bay, dad lives in Hollywood. So they have to transition and be transported back and forth literally every other day, and then except for longer periods of time on the weekend. So that's a big burden for such young kids. And so the call that I got from her essentially was her venting her frustration at him for doing this. Why would he do this to me? How dare he do this? He knows I'm their mother. He knows that I'm with them all the time. He works 80, 90 hours a week. So he's just pawning them off on a babysitter. All completely valid feelings, all completely valid emotions, and valid concerns even from a legal perspective. However, there's not much that I can do other than really guide my client as to, okay, well, this is how the court might look at that issue. This is how the court might look at the logistics issue of the transportation. I'm not really trained to give her the emotional support that I think she really needs. And of course, I'm going to do my best to do that, of course, because I care and I'm a father and I understand how she's feeling, but I don't have the formal training or the experience as a therapist to give the guidance that I think she was really looking for. So my recommendation to her several times during the call and even in prior calls was, hey, let's get you a really good therapist that you can talk to, or even get on, you know, on Skype or Zoom or something, because I know you're busy as a mom. And the joke I always tell my clients is, you know, I'm happy to be your therapist if you want, but I don't even have half the training, but I'm twice as expensive. So, you know.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Because I find the same thing comes through my office. As a mediator, one of the things I do is I try and show people how to phrase things differently, because it's the way we communicate to one another that will elicit a reaction of some sort.
Absolutely.
And I was going to ask you, so thank you for advancing it, do you have therapists that you actually recommend? Because you can tell in a second whether somebody needs that support or not.
I do. And really, I have a lot of really good professionals that I work with throughout the LA area, and some even in Orange County, Ventura County. So when I'm trying to, and I give referrals, obviously, I give the names and contact information. And so when I do that for a client, I generally give at least two or three different potential ones, because it is critical for the as far as I can perceive, for the therapist-patient relationship to have good communication, open communication, and comfort, so that you can meaningfully participate in the therapy process. And another thing that I look at is, well, what type of therapist do we really need here? I mean, is this a situation, and I may not be using the right terms, but is this where talk therapy is good for just the client to help him or her with their emotions? Or is this where someone who's more of a high conflict divorcing families specialist who can act as more of a co-parenting counselor for both of the parents to help them? That's another thing I look at.
And then lastly, because I've had Bill Eddy on the show, I don't know if you know of him. We have a two-part interview in January I posted. Bill Eddy is the guru of personality disorders. And we all have to get good at noticing not only the garden variety of emotion that people go through in divorce, which is tough enough, but we have to be attuned to maybe this is an actual personality disorder. And should we even be taking this case?
Yeah.
Because it can blow up in our faces, can't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, and I do get those types of clients. And I try not to turn clients away because I find that, you know, if they've struggled with other attorneys, I find myself, and I hate to brag about myself, but I do find, and I've heard this from clients of mine, that I'm a very effective communicator in the sense that I can not only listen, but I can explain things much more clearly than a lot of attorneys are able to do. And I always say, again, joking, that that's because I have a simple mind. So in my mind, I try and take these big legal terms and concepts and break them down into simplicity so that I understand them. And then if I can convey that to someone else, then that helps them understand as well. And so, you know, I think that really the key that I find to helping someone with a personality disorder is keeping things very factual, very straightforward, transparent, and realistic. And giving them, rather than telling them how something is going to go, giving them the numerous possible outcomes so that they can then understand, okay, well, this is what I want and this is what I believe, but my attorney's telling me this could happen or this could happen. And I find that to be pretty effective with my clients who have those issues.
You know, just knowing you for the number of years that I have, I believe this because I find it easy to talk with you and I don't know everything. You're an attorney. I'm not. Things come up in my office that I need to have explained to me.
Of course.
First time things. And I appreciate that. And I do understand that it's a foreign language.
Yes.
When you enter the law arena, any type of law, it's a foreign language. And we have to be mindful of that. Even the word conformed.
Yes.
When I tell my clients that I'm filing for, okay, so here's the conformed version. Okay, here's the processed version from the court.
Yes.
And then we tend to use acronyms because when we talk to one another, it's easy.
Yep.
We fall into that sometimes.
Of course.
So we have to be mindful. So
RFO, TSC, MSC, OSC, DV, TRO.
So I thank you and I appreciate that.
Of course.
Mistake number two, please.
All right. So mistake number two, and this applies in any case where children are involved. And that is that joint custody does not always equal 50-50. And I can't tell you how many new clients call me and I ask them the all-important question once I find out that they have children. In your mind, what do you believe the schedule should be? And the only response that I get is 50-50. So then I have to follow it up with, well, how would that work in a given week? And they would most likely say, I don't know, 50-50. And what I'm trying to convey there, and what I do explain to them is, rather than using numbers, give specific proposals when it comes to physical custody. Give me a schedule that you think would be approximately equal but would work for your children. And so what I often do then is I give examples of some of the more conventional custody schedules we see, such as a 2-2-5-5, which is where, you know, one parent has them, say, Monday, Tuesday, the other has them Wednesday, Thursday, and then they alternate the weekends on an alternating weekly schedule, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which ends up equating to 2 days with mom, 2 days with dad, 5 days with mom, 5 days with dad. And then they start kind of understanding how the court right. looks at these things. And then there's the other point of custody is not just the schedule. Custody also has to do with legal custody, which is decision making. And that's a big thing people don't even consider. And I can't tell you, you know, one way to gauge how upset and heated a case might be is to see how the potential client reacts to sharing legal custody, having equal decision making.
Meaning joint custody
joint
in California.
Legal. Correct. Yeah. Joint legal custody. Or not even giving the other parent the ability to make decisions about their children, which would be sole legal custody. And so that's also very telling of the mindset of a new client coming in. And I'll tell you from experience, it is not easy to get sole legal custody in the family law court system these days. It's possible, but it's not easy. You really have to show an egregious and consistent pattern of one parent making it almost impossible for the other parent to co-parent or communicate with them, I find.
Let's talk for a second about legal custody versus physical custody.
Sure.
Because in the California courts, and it may be similar in other states, there's a difference between the two.
Yes, yes.
Would you explain?
So again, the legal custody has to do with decision-making about important issues, non-emergency issues for the children. Of course, nobody wants to prevent a child from being able to go to the ER if they've hurt themselves or something like that for an obvious need. But when we talk about things, typical legal custody issues would include, for example, where the children may go to school. Are they going to go to a private school? Are they going to go to a public school? Are they going to participate in any sort of extra curricular activities or tutoring or maybe learning another language or participating in some kind of religious study? Attendance of religious ceremonies is a very common issue. How the children are going to be raised. You know, if you have one parent maybe who's Jewish and the other one who's Christian, that can often be a conflict between them.
Quite often.
And, you know, what I find on that issue, many judges, regardless of their religious affiliation, often want the children exposed to both religions. So even judges don't necessarily see it as a conflict. They see it as a benefit to have exposure to all kinds of faiths.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear.
Yeah. I've had that issue numerous instances.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
And then, so medical, cultural, religious, mm-hmm. on legal side,
yeah.
physical side.
So on the physical side, generally speaking, you're talking about the schedule that the children are going to have with parent number one and parent number two. How that's going to look in on a weekly format, a biweekly format. But it also includes things such as, well, how are we going to spend holidays? We have to come up with a holiday schedule. What are we going to do about Thanksgiving? What are we going to do about summer break, spring break? Do each parent get to take the kids for maybe 2 weeks or so and go travel outside of California? Those are often physical custody issues that are important to consider. What do we do about mom's birthday or dad's birthday? What do we do about the children's birthday, right?
I know they don't often think that far down the line
right.
because they're overwhelmed.
Right.
And they're just doing the big ticket things.
Right.
Primary custody.
Yes.
This
Yes.
Really confuses me.
Sure.
Because there's no box to check on
Correct.
Forms.
Correct.
Could you clarify that?
Absolutely. And so what you're referring to, Judy, is when someone files a petition in California, they have to make important selections right at the outset of what they're asking for. And so in the section, when you have minor children dealing with child custody, you're exactly right. There's literally one line with a few boxes there. And the boxes are very limiting. There's box one for petitioner, the one who filed. There's box two for respondent, the one who's responding. There's a box for joint, and then there's a box for other. That's it. How do you conform to that, especially if you don't have an attorney to explain things to you and you have no clue exactly what you think is best? So right then and there, there is no box for primary, right?
Yes.
And there is not technically a definition of primary under the family code or under any case law. It seems, though, that it is a common term that gets thrown around by attorneys, by pro per litigants, and even by judges.
That's right.
In their rulings.
Yes.
And so while there is no legal meaning to it, there kind of is a legal meaning to it if it's being used in the legal system. So the way I look at it is, technically speaking, primary should just apply to the timeshare. And the timeshare would be a numerical analysis of what percentage of, say, a month each parent has with the child. And if, for example, one parent has more than 50%, one could argue that that is essentially de facto primary custody. And it does have consequences because there are certain custody issues that where if somebody can prove that they're the primary custodial parent, so to speak, that they may have an advantage if they try and move out of state or do certain things with the children even after the case is over and things have changed.
So in terms of avoiding a mistake, are you suggesting that when people come in to work with you, they should be maybe just a little more open-minded to what would work for their particular divorce situation?
Of course. I mean, I think that I would say is can be somewhat wishful thinking, because obviously when people are coming in, the process is so new and they're not even used to life as two separate households. So that's a huge adjustment. And I'm aware of that. But what I think I really would recommend to clients coming and talking to me is just really focus on what the schedule would be, taking into account your individual children's needs and how those would be met. You know, if you have a child, say, who doesn't do well in the car, obviously we want to come up with a schedule that minimizes transition time between households. Maybe if there's a big distance between where one parent lives and the other parent lives, maybe we can meet halfway. You know, maybe we can come up with some other way to minimize the impact that would have on the child. Or, you know, if a child has to go see a specific doctor whose office is right by mom's house, well, let's try and coordinate the schedule so that mom has custody at or around the time of the appointments when they generally are. Just things like that. The specifics of your family, I think you really need to think about and come up with a plan.
Okay, now, because before we leave this, I have one last consideration for you to address, please. And that is something that comes up more often than anybody would want, and that is when one parent is addicted to something,
sure.
Addicted to mostly substance abuse, but
sure.
It can be anything,
sure.
And the other parent, just to get the divorce over with, just to make nice, we'll say, well, let's do joint custody, joint legal, joint physical. And you're giving your children to somebody who may be under the influence while they're having the kids and an accident could happen. That's a mistake, wouldn't you think, coming in to grant joint custody just to get it over with?
I would. I mean, that's, you know, whenever you have somebody who's addicted, when I hear that word, I envision somebody who has lost control to whatever it is they're addicted to and is at a point where that addiction, that substance, whether it's alcohol, drugs, prescription pills, being abused, whatever it is, that overruns their ability to handle a vehicle or safely care for their children, keep their children adequately supervised. So that's a fundamental safety issue that really should at least temporarily preclude true joint physical custody until the addicted parent can get that under control. And how they do that obviously is something for a completely other expert, but usually it's going to involve going to treatment, getting into a 12-step program, In a lot of cases, you would, and I've done this before in cases before you have joint physical custody, starting when you have an addicted parent, you would need the addicted parent to consistently drug test at a laboratory clean or do alcohol testing. There's this wonderful new device/program called SoberLink that is gaining a lot of traction with in the family law community. And it's this really great device. It's basically like a breathalyzer that links with your cell phone through Bluetooth. And what it does is, and they're not a paid sponsor of mine by any means,
but I love their
product. And I have it going on in actually multiple cases right now. And what it does is it's this high-tech breathalyzer that actually does facial recognition to make sure it is the actual parent using the device, so they're not giving it to somebody else. And they blow into it, and it tests their BAC, their blood alcohol level. And what we do, and I literally have a case right now where there are accusations that my client can't control his alcohol use. So we've had him actually voluntarily doing it at the start of every his custodial time, in the evening, again in the morning, again in the evening, and again before leaving to drop the kids off. So we have definitive evidence, and we can even actually have those results live shared by email with me, my opposing counsel, and the opposing party. So you're getting real-time results and data, which is even better than when you go to a lab for your analysis and it takes a day or two to get the results back. And that I find helps tremendously.
That is wonderful. And so let your attorney guide the discussion. This is what I'm getting out of this.
Sure.
Let your attorney guide the discussion when you go to fill out the petition or response for joint versus sole custody.
Absolutely.
Don't do it just to get the divorce over faster so that you don't anger the spouse, because that other spouse needs help.
Correct. And one thing that I've been doing a lot in petitions I've been filing that I find kind of preserves my client's rights but doesn't come off as offensive as checking the box for sole custody by one parent is I'll, in the other box on the petition, at the very end, I'll check other, where it says physical custody and visitation.
Right.
And I'll, using my PDF software, I'll put in a little note saying, according to best interests of the children.
Oh, nice.
And that then pretty much holds every option open for you. I haven't had a problem with it, and I've seen other colleagues do it as well. It holds every option open for you if you ever have to go to court to litigate custody. But by the same token, it doesn't make that statement that the opposing party often interprets as a declaration of warfare when you check the sole custody, whether it's sole legal, sole physical box.
Yes, that is. Thank you for that tip. By the way, I'm going to use that tip because you're exactly right. It's not an act of warfare. You don't want to weaponize or put the other person on the defensive.
Right.
But we are looking at best interest of the children.
Right.
And the goal is to equally co-parent as much as possible, as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Next, number three.
All right, so number three, and this is one you might appreciate, Judy. This is rushing to court before going to mediation. Now, I preface this with, of course, there are emergency situations where the only option you have is to run into court when there's a valid safety concern, there's some kind of urgency, whether it be on the child custody. If, for example, you had an addicted parent who took the kids, that's certainly fine to run into court as fast as you can. Or if they've taken off with the children and you don't know where they are, totally fine. But if we're talking about, you know, setting the case for trial without trying to reach a settlement of the issues, that to me is a tremendous mistake, because so many cases can and should be resolved by mediation. When you look at it from the court's perspective, the instances when there should be a trial is when there really is a big disparity in both parties' account of the facts of the case. Okay, that's a big general way of describing. You know, for example, if one party says there's a business involved and they say it's worth $20 million and the other party says, no, the business is worth $20, I mean, there you might just have to have a trial on that issue. Okay. However, if we can agree on other things, such as this is when we got married, this is when we separated, and we can just do some basic accounting to figure out how much of a retirement account belongs to the community, which would be split, versus separate property, if it was accumulated before marriage or after separation, that's an easy fix. We don't need to have a judge decide that, you know?
Right.
Or another example, if we're talking about determining child support and spousal support, if we have two W-2 wage earners who don't have any other sources of income other than their paychecks, all of which are very clearly documented in reliable pay stubs and W-2s issued by, you know, ADP or Paychex or one of those big companies that's, you know, dealing with a lot of people's payroll, we can figure out what the numbers should be pretty easily. There might be a slight discrepancy based on some deductions or things like that, but the window of disagreement is often very, very narrow. And if you come to court and you litigate an issue that is fairly straightforward like that, which even happened to me a couple weeks ago when the opposing counsel and opposing party just wouldn't agree to what the disso master said, judges are not happy with that. And judges will even keep you there and send you out into the court hallway to try and reach an agreement. And they'll say things. I had this one really great judge who I know and I've had cases with many times say, this is a W-2 wage earner. I don't know why you are here in my courtroom.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it should be so easy.
It's so straightforward.
You run the calculator that everybody uses.
So straightforward.
Uses. Yeah.
Yeah. Because we had custody orders in place. We have a schedule. The parties are adhering to the schedule. There's no dispute as to the percentage of timeshare. The income is documented in pay stubs. We had the most recent pay stubs as well as a W-2. And we have everything else, all the health insurance, the property taxes, everything is documented. And it was all plugged into a disso master. But the fundamental problem we had was that the earning spouse did not want to pay child support or spousal support just because he didn't want to. And, you know, when you disagree with California law and you go into the courtroom, pretty much 99.9% of the time, California law wins.
Will preside. So
yeah.
The reason why mediation is good, too, is because of this concept. But I know exactly how the judge is going to rule. First of all, he's going to rule in my favor. Mm. I just know. How could a judge not think like me?
Right.
Right?
Right.
So they
right.
don't think like you. They think
True.
Like the law.
True.
And if you're not clearly conversant with the law and accept the fact that the judge has to adhere to the law, right, Matthew?
Right. Correct.
So ergo mediation allows you to be creative. Talk about why mediation
yes.
is a benefit.
Yes. And before I do so, let me make one more point. I do find that many cases need what I call the bad taste of litigation in order to settle in mediation. And what I mean by that is people need to become disenfranchised with the idea that you just articulated, that they are certain the judge will agree with them 100%. They need a reality check to go to court, wait around all day, and then have their 15, 20 minutes before the judge who then and does not agree with them. And once they get that reality check, they become disillusioned with this fantasy that the courtroom is going to be this wonderful equalizer for them where they're going to get their vengeance, or they're going to be vindicated, or the other person's going to be found to be this awful person and they're going to be found to be a wonderful person. I mean, you know, one thing I tell clients is, you know, most of the time, the family law court is not going to give you revenge. Most of the time, you're going to both walk out dissatisfied about something. And so to connect to what you were mentioning, when you go to mediation, you retain so much more control and you have creative freedom. And what I mean by that is if you can reach an agreement with your spouse, unless there's some major public policy violation of that agreement, the court's going to adopt your agreement and is going to implement it as its orders, whether that's through what we call a stipulated judgment, which is the overall settlement of the case, or even a temporary settlement called a stipulation in order of maybe some of the issues. Courts are going to essentially rubber stamp your agreement. Okay. And in that understanding, you then realize, oh, we have creative freedom to work in whatever we want. So for example, if we can settle child custody, maybe what we do is we say, okay, let's not have a default schedule in the first place. Let's say we both will agree and we'll work together to come up with a schedule that works on a day-by-day or case-by-case basis. However, if at some point we can't agree, here's our fallback schedule that will kick in. That's great. I love that concept and I use it in
too.
A lot of cases.
Yeah.
However, the court cannot do that. The court will just,
oh.
if the court's going to rule on somebody filing an RFO, which stands for request for order, or a motion asking for a court order,
right.
court's just going to issue a schedule. They're not going to give you a fallback option. And so the fallback option probably would work better for the family. You know, if mom or dad has to, you know, go to work on a different day or they have some family event, it's nice for them to have the flexibility to be able to change the schedule without it causing major legal problems, right? However, the court figures if you're coming to us, you guys don't have that level of cooperation, so we're just going to solve the problem for you. And that's a really scary prospect when you think about it, because a judge has 10, 20, 30 cases before him or her in a given day. There's no way that that judge is going to give the attention or have the knowledge of the nuances of your case to the same degree that the two actual parents do and the attorneys likely do. So,
right.
You know, I guess it's almost like if you were to ask someone to write a textbook, you would probably want, for example, it's an architecture textbook. You'd probably want an architect who's been doing architecture for decades to write it rather than, you know, a mathematics professor who's been teaching, you know, 10th grade geometry to write it. They might know, but they don't know the level of depth and experience and nuances that the other would have. So those are kind of things I try and explain to my clients, and that by going through mediation, you retain creative freedom.
Okay, so you said one really interesting thing to me, and that is the fallback position, the step-up plan, the
sure.
plan B will not be given by the judge. Well, I don't go to court, so I actually wouldn't know that.
Sure.
I read minute orders, and yes, if I were to think back on the minute orders that I've inherited from people who have been to court and then want to finish on their own, no, I don't see a plan B. Mm-hmm. And if we were to look at the former example we used under custody, if you have a substance abuse parent, mm-hmm. I have seen too many of them say, I'm just going to court. I want to leave mediation, the substance abuse
sure.
parent. Well, for all of you who may unfortunately have that affliction, mediation would obviously work better for you.
100%.
Because if for some reason the judge clearly understands somehow the evidence is you cannot have your children now, you're saying, Matthew, the order will be sole custody, 100% to the non-addicted parent.
I mean, in cases of substance abuse, that is a very common result. I mean, I think back to one of the more recent ones I had, where the mother had an alcohol problem, prescription pill problem. She overdosed on pills on Mother's Day and was found face down on the floor by her 11-year-old daughter on Mother's Day. She was then on a ventilator in the hospital for about a week. And that's pretty clear evidence of having a really serious problem. In that case, the order we got from the court, because the other side would not agree to anything less than joint physical custody, we had to go in on an emergency or an ex parte motion. And what we got was sole physical custody for my client, the father, and we had monitored visits for mom until she got her issues under control. And that, you know, I mean, it's really sad when you see those. I hate cases like that, and they're really tough, but under the circumstances, when you're talking about a child's safety, sometimes you don't have any other option.
I know.
You know, and I, as a parent myself, I can't imagine being able to see my kids only 1 hour a week with some stranger there keeping an eye on me. I mean, my God, you know. And in other cases where we've had these issues, one thing I've done is the mother had a really bad alcohol problem, but she didn't want to go to treatment in part because she was afraid that that would be used against her as evidence of her having an addiction that would have longer term consequences for her custody. So what we did, another example of creative freedom of custody, we entered into a stipulation where we agreed that mother could go to treatment. Her going to treatment was not in any way an admission, nor would any evidentiary inferences be drawn from that. And in fact, any evidence regarding what she did at treatment, what she said, any testing she may have done would all be deemed inadmissible.
And because mediation is a confidential process, a lot of this conversation, which is extremely important, goes no further than the room.
Sure.
Just the bottom line decisions.
Sure.
Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct. There is, in California at least, and I think in many other states, it's what we call the mediation privilege, which is everything that is said during the course of a mediation is confidential and cannot be admissible in court.
Excellent. Okay, point number four, mistake number four.
Mistake number four, yes. When clients do not prepare for the inevitable delays of the court system. And That has always been true throughout, you know, at least the last 10 years. The court system is very, very slow. It often takes multiple court appearances to accomplish something for a number of reasons. It could be some specific issue in the case. Maybe somebody needs more documents. Somebody needs more time to respond, whatever that might be. Or it could just be that the court is just too congested on other matters and they have to go by a priority at which domestic violence is at the top, child custody is below that, child support below that, spousal support and other financial issues below that, and at the bottom are the procedural things. So depending on what you're there for, if you're there for a procedural matter, such as a trial setting conference, perhaps just to get a trial date, it's very common for those to just get continued due to court congestion. Now, fast forward to 2020, in these COVID-19 times where the court was closed for several months and there's a huge backlog of cases, now you're talking about extraordinary delays beyond what you had before. I'll give you a couple examples. I had a case that I filed a RFO, a motion, asking for child support for my client who had been cut off by the father of her children. We filed that on New Year's Eve 2019. Due to not only COVID-19, but a few other internal procedural delays, such as the judge who'd been assigned to our case actually had a friendship and a close relationship with my opposing counsel, so she had to recuse herself, and then the case being transferred to a courtroom that then the judge got moved to a different division, doing a different kind of law other than family law, and they closed the department and reassigned all the cases, causing other delays through no fault of anybody's, and then followed by multiple delays from COVID-19. That motion that was filed on New Year's Eve is now not set for hearing until just before Christmas time, 2020. Another example, I filed a what's called a post-judgment RFO or motion.
After divorce.
After divorce. And this was done about a week ago. Now, first of all, it took several weeks just to get the paperwork filed due to issues within the court system, congestion, budget cuts leading to less staff processing paperwork. But in any event, it got filed. It was filed in early August 2020. It is set for hearing in March 2021. That's the first available date.
Yes.
And this is a RFO to sell a property that had been left open, so to speak, in the party's settlement agreement back in 2003, that they agreed to allow one spouse to live in so that their children could continue attending high school at a specific high school where the property was located, with the intention that they would readdress the issue 5 or 6 years down the line once the last child graduated from high school. Well, they didn't do that timely. They took a few extra years, but then they reached an impasse. One person refused to sell. The other wanted it sold. Come 2020, they come to me. We file the motion, but lo and behold,
COVID.
Yeah. So the bottom line is you have to be prepared for delay. And that's particularly important when you're what we call the out spouse, which is the one receiving support. Correct. And the one who usually needs support just to sustain their livelihood, because you're not going to get an urgent support payment unless there's some very, very, very extraordinary circumstances. It's very hard to get your request for support put ahead of the line of the other folks that have filed theirs and have been waiting.
So how do people deal with not being prepared for the inevitable delays? What do they do?
Sure.
Financially, what do they do?
Sure. I mean, really, the only thing that they can do is they have to have some kind of a nest egg, get some kind of emergency fund put together that you have in place before you even start the divorce process, just enough to cover several months, maybe 6 months, say, of your expenses, if you can get that. Or have perhaps enough credit available to you, whether it's through a line of credit or credit cards, or even if you have a family member or friend who you know you can rely on to help you if you need it, just some kind of support system financially or a nest egg just to help you get through so you can get to court.
Well, what do you do for child support, which is a number one issue financially
Sure.
in a divorce? How do you handle that? There are two households. Mm-hmm. The situation would be two households. You're two attorneys representing each side. What do you do? How do you take care of the kids?
Well, so in California, there is actually a statewide guideline, which is a long mathematical formula. It looks almost like an algorithm, right? For us simple-minded attorneys, they have codified that into a program called DisoMaster, which pretty much all of us use, which most of the judges use. And there are other kinds of calculators. Child Support Services has its own, and some other counties have their own. However, the bottom line is it's a very simple program that just plugs in certain inputs to generate a number under the statewide guideline. So where the fight often happens is not as much when you have clear-cut income numbers, such as you would see from a W-2 or, you know, a pay stub type of employee. But let's say you have somebody who's self-employed, okay? That is often one of the hardest issues to litigate because a lot of self-employed people have their financial statements done in a way that it looks like they don't make any money. In fact, they're always losing money.
Well, isn't that the tax game?
Right, right. You know, it's fun. Yeah. I can't tell you how many cases I have where the self-employed in-spouses, he's losing hundreds of thousands. I hate to say he because it does go both ways. There are he and she, but just...
But predominantly it's still male payor.
Correct, correct, in most cases. Yeah. And it's amazing when you see someone who drives a Bentley, who flies on private jets, who belongs to a country club and a beach club, who vacations in Aspen, goes to New York, goes to Hawaii and all that, but just isn't making any money. And so that's where we turn to forensic accountants to help us as our expert witnesses. And they're the ones that will then take a look at the books of the company. They'll look at the profit and loss statement. They'll look at the general ledger. They'll look at the paid bills file. And they'll start kind of analyzing, okay, while these expenses may be valid for purposes of the IRS or the California Franchise Tax Board, they're not for purposes of family law because they're personal in nature. They're not necessary or ordinary business expenses. There's a big difference between, buying inventory versus paying for Laker tickets, right? So you have to really look at the individual circumstances of the case. And again, when you have someone who's self-employed, child support and spousal support is a very complex issue, and you have to almost always enlist the help of a forensic accountant.
So lastly on this point, though, Matthew, you do have to have some money to be engaged in this dual attorney process.
True.
And the separation of things. But how long should somebody prepare before they engage in a divorce to get their money together? I mean, it's all individual, isn't it?
It's very individual, and there's no set formula. But really, the way I would look at it and what I tell people who call me up who aren't quite ready to go forward with the divorce and they need some time, I would give them a few specific tasks or goals to accomplish, right?
Oh, that's good.
So number one, when it comes to custody, is create a child custody log. And what that is really is, there's no magic way to do it. You could do it in a written calendar. You could use an app on your phone or your tablet. You could use a spreadsheet, whatever it is. But what you want to do is you want to go in and document what the day-to-day is like for the children. And it can be very tedious, but if you do it, it pays dividends because each day you go back and track, well, what happened on Monday? What happened, you know, last month on the second day? Who's taking the kids to school? Who's taking them to baseball practice? Who's taking them to dance? Who's taking them to tutoring? Who's taking them to the pediatrician? Where are they going on the weekends? Who are they spending time with? If the parties are separated, but they haven't started the legal process, when they go see the other parent, are they actually with the other parent or are they with grandma and grandpa while the other parent goes out and, you know, plays golf or something?
Very typical.
These are all things to document. And a lot of people kind of resist that. They say, oh, well, I remember. No, you don't remember that level of detail. 99% of humans can't, unless you have a photographic memory. That's why we create the log, and the log also becomes a visual illustration for the judge if you ever litigate the issue. So that's one task I tell them. Task number two, I tell them, gather up a file, okay? And what I mean by that is gather up some recent tax returns, some business financial statements, supporting documents for tax returns, W-2s, 1099s, account statements. Gather all of that up as much as you can and keep a file for yourself. And the reason for that is if you need to go into court to get support, for example, you got to have some kind of evidence to show what the other person's income is. And if they don't provide it to you, if they withhold it, they make you go through the discovery process of obtaining documents by things such as document demands or subpoenas or things like that. If you have something to show the court, you can at least get an initial order in place.
Okay. So what I'm hearing from this is, A, the court system is long and arduous. So if you can mediate and move yourself along, better for you.
Absolutely.
But if you can't, and there are some people that can't even be in the same room together, if you cannot, be as organized as possible,
yep,
be as self-sufficient as possible in the meantime, and then when you are in court, it'll go better once you get in front of the judge.
Yes.
Fair to say?
Absolutely. And I find it'll also even go better if you're the one who extends the olive branch and offers mediation. Even if the other side doesn't take it, you will always be able to say, whether you're litigating custody or trying to get your attorney's fees paid, that you are settlement oriented, that you put the offer out there and they refuse. Because if they refuse, that mediation privilege never kicks in because the mediation never happened.
Right, right.
I find that helps a lot. And I also, you know, when a new client calls me, one of the first things I ask them is, have the both of you talked about mediation? And a lot of times they haven't. And I recommend, and I, while I might be losing business for myself, I generally say, why don't you try calling a mediator like Judy Weigel?
Thank you.
And you know, give it a shot and see. And maybe you can't work everything out, but maybe you can work out custody. And then if you come into the legal process, all you're fighting over is money at that point.
Right. Okay, so this is why I love referring you, because you look out for the client first.
Of course.
Which is so important. And people have this impression of attorneys that they don't have a heart, and
right,
it's just all about money. And of course, I think there are some people like that, but there are some wonderful, fabulous people like yourself who actually care.
There are.
About servicing the
there
greater
are.
Good of the human beings going through divorce.
You know, the way I look at it is, I would say probably 9 out of 10 family law attorneys do care,
yeah,
and are good,
yeah,
and are looking out for not only the best interests of their clients, but the children involved. I mean, at the end of the day, while we're family law attorneys, we're human beings.
Yes.
You know, we have children.
Yes.
We have parents. We have brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews. I mean, we are human beings. And so, it again, 90% of us are very good and very reasonable and not trying to cause trouble, not trying to extort our clients or bankrupt them or anything like that. However, just like many other things in life, regardless of what profession or whatever you want to apply it to, it's that 10%.
That's right, the
that
few
cause,
bad apples.
The 10% cause 100% of the damage.
Right,
you
and then of
mean?
Course you have the movies and the TV
of
shows
course,
that support
course.
That because it's good TV
of
and movies.
Course.
But that's not the reality.
True.
And all of us in the business will have good people to refer to you.
100%.
Lastly.
Okay. Mistake number 5, the final mistake. Making decisions in your family law case based on emotion, as opposed to reason, or as opposed to treating it as a business decision. And I completely understand how people make this mistake, because this process is absolutely emotionally charged. How can it not be? I mean, this is a death of a relationship is what it is. You know, I heard this, I can't remember who it was, this one philosophy expert basically said that divorce is a division of force. And when you look at that and you think of it that way, you have two forces that have come together as one, and they're now dividing that force up. So just from a physics perspective, when that happens, there's bound to be some kind of a reaction, a negative reaction, because you're cutting this force in half, right?
Yes.
So I totally understand when my clients are having a hard time. They probably never imagined when they were saying their vows that they would be calling me, you know? No way. Nobody ever does. But the statistics are there. It happens. People change. Lives change. People grow. People grow apart. People have different values. People have catastrophes happen to them. They lose a child, for God's sake. I mean, these horrible stories, you know, that just stretch people. And the relationship is over, and they're upset about it, understandably. Maybe there was an affair. Maybe there was abuse. Maybe there was some recurring issue with a family member getting too close and involved. Whatever it might be, there's valid emotion there, for sure. And this circles back, I think, even to number one, which is the best thing you can do to help you process that is go through therapy and use a therapist who's so good and so trained and so specializes in helping you go through the process of grieving the loss of your marriage so that when it comes time to make decisions, you're looking at it purely from an economic, financial perspective and also from the bigger picture perspective as to what's best for you and your family.
I like that you used the word economic perspective.
Yeah.
I know we all say, you know, these are business decisions, and it's very hard for people to accept that word business when they're in a highly emotional state.
Of course.
I think you said it better right now. These are economic decisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. And they can't be made emotionally. So one of the things that I have said, and I've done episodes myself on this, and that is there's the emotional divorce and there's the legal divorce. And other people have talked about this
Absolutely.
Too. And I can tell in a second when I get a couple here, because I work with, when I'm filing, I work with both people. I file for both of them. I can tell in a second when they've gone through the emotional divorce first. It's a really easy conversation because they've processed the anger, the hurt, the blame, the betrayal, and they've come out the other side because you have to or you'll die.
Absolutely.
You'll eat yourself away.
Absolutely.
And now they're ready to make the economic decisions.
Yes.
That's wonderful.
It is.
I want to add a sixth mistake
okay.
for you, and I would like you to address this,
all right.
please. All right. So all lawyers have their contracts. You have the retainer fee to open up the case, but there's going to be more money after that because
right.
you will work against that retainer in your hourly fee when you're talking on the phone, responding to emails, or going to court with them.
Correct.
I would like you to address how much time it takes for an attorney to write a simple email back. Mm-hmm. It takes more time than people imagine. Email doesn't have the context that phone voice does. And even me, when I'm writing emails, I decide, do I want to make this a phone call? Do I want to make this an email?
Sure.
Because if I'm doing follow-up mediation, I charge by the hour.
Okay.
So I will charge for my time writing emails. Don't you, Matthew, even more you as an attorney, worry about what words you put on paper, how they're going to be accepted and processed, and this, what the result will be in how the client processes that information?
Absolutely. There's a huge difference between communicating by email and communicating by phone. The way I approach it is, if we're talking a simple email, that in my mind means things such as, oh, let's schedule a call time, or this is, here's a copy of something that just came in that's not an important document, you know, just maybe a notice or something from the court. Those are very quick to write, a few minutes at most. But if we're talking a substantive dialogue about strategy, possible outcomes of the case, big issues in the case, most of the time those are best suited for a telephone call because the telephone call is much more interactive. You can gauge the person's tone. You can kind of hear if they're understanding you or if they're not. They can immediately ask you questions. Whereas the email, the way you phrase things, the way you word things is subject to completely different interpretations from one person to the next. And what I find happens, if you're concerned about your bill and you're concerned about time, I know a lot of clients try and control that by sending me emails and they want questions answered. However, what often happens is I answer the questions in email and it just results in follow-up questions. So now we're having an ongoing back and forth, which is fine, not a problem. But almost always that could be better suited for a 10-15 minute phone conversation where it can all be answered. And I will say this, most attorneys are always more cautious in writing than they are on the telephone. And the reason for that is if it's in writing, it exists in perpetuity. And attorneys are always concerned that, you know, if they say something wrong or if they do something wrong, that that's going to come back and be thrown in their face by someone who then comes after them. You know, and so that's just the attorney's mindset. of putting it in writing versus telephone. However, you know, the way I conduct myself, I try and just speak on the phone the same way I would in email. And I find that that helps my clients just understand that I'm being authentic with them. I have no problem if we're talking about something important and the client wants it in writing, I'm happy to send a follow-up email. I'm, you know, there's nothing for me to hide here, you know, and I think a lot of lawyers feel that same way. But of course, you know, when it comes to controlling your bill and your costs, I find that if you can schedule a specific call time with your attorney, that's often the best thing. And I say that because, you know, our days are so busy, whether we're in court or in a deposition or in a meeting or on the phone, it's very rare that I can't think of the last time I've just been sitting at my desk waiting for the phone to ring. I'm always doing something. But if a client needs to talk to me, if they want to email me or text me even, because I give my cell phone to my clients, we can set a time to talk. I put it on my calendar and we have that discussion and I'm prepared for it. They're prepared for it. It just makes things go smoother. And I find that helps control the bill as well.
Thank you. That's exactly the point I wanted to get across, because people are in sticker shock sometimes.
Yeah.
And they'll say, well, it was just a paragraph.
Right.
But you have to think about that paragraph.
Correct.
So if you can organize yourself as a client, as a litigant, and minimize the emails,
yep.
Go by phone appointments for a lot, mm-hmm. and then put the documentation in writing subsequently.
Sure.
I think you can manage the money that you spend and still get exceptional representation.
I agree.
Thank you, Matthew. Matthew, this was just wonderful. How do people get in touch with you? Because I know they're going to want to.
Of course. Well, they can go to my website, which is Smurda Law, my last name, smurdalaw.com. Or they can call me at my office, 424-253-1177. Again, 424-253-1177.
You're going to come back, aren't you?
I would love to come
There's
back.
There's so
great.
Much to talk about.
Absolutely. This was an absolute pleasure, Judy.
Thank you
for having me.
My pleasure, please. And all of you, thank you for joining me on Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. If you would like to get in touch with me, you can by email, Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com, or through my website, divorceresourceinc.com, divorceresourceinc.com. I appreciate all of you listening. Please tell your friends who are about to go through divorce or are. There's a wealth of information on this podcast with fabulous people like attorney Matthew Smurda. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.